All right. I didn't start this chapter last time, right?
No.
Didn't have time. Okay. So we're going to talk about DNA replication in this chapter, which is, of course, one of the two major jobs of DNA. And that's the job of the two. DNA replication is the job that really doesn't have anything to do with the lifetime of that cell, right? That's all about preparing for the two cells that one cell will become. In other words, DNA replication comes toward the end of the life of a cell when it's about to split. And cell division happens in different ways in the dichotomy of cell types. Eukaryotes do it a certain way. Prokaryotes do it a different way. What we're looking at the top here is mitosis, and we'll look at mitosis in detail in a different chapter. But what is mitosis? What is it? It's not actually cell division. It's can be considered part of cell division. What is mitosis does not occur in prokaryotes. Mitosis is division of the nucleus. And you can't divide the nucleus if you don't have a nucleus. So prokaryotes don't undergo mitosis. Cytokinesis is division of the cytoplasm. So the two go hand in hand in eukaryotic cell division. But the DNA copies get separated from each other in a eukaryote during mitosis because the DNA is contained in that nucleus that's being split. Well, that is just a little sliver of the overall cell cycle. But DNA replication does not occur in this M phase in which mitosis occurs. It occurs earlier on in the S phase of interphase. So by the time a cell gets to mitosis, the DNA has already been replicated. The chromatin is replicated already by the time you get to the M phase. By the time you see the chromosomes, which is chromatin that has been compressed to the point where you actually see individual chromosomes, those are already replicated chromosomes because the cell has already been through S phase. That's why you see, when you finally see chromosomes, there's two legs to them. They look like little X's because of that. They are replicated chromosomes. Let's go to 2. The cartoon we're looking at here illustrates the notion of semi-conservative replication in DNA. If you were to design things, which of course is not how evolution works, you could replicate DNA any of three fundamentally different ways. You could do it fully conservatively, semi-conservatively, or in a dispersed fashion. What I'm talking about is what happens to the old material versus the new material. And in this figure, darker blue represents older DNA, DNA that's already there. Lighter blue represents the new DNA that's being built. A semi-conservative model for replication says that when replication occurs, the two strands separate. They're both original dark blue DNA. But once they fully separate and one whole strand remains intact with original DNA in it, and an entirely new strand is built using that original strand as a template. Meanwhile, the same thing happens to the other original strand. So in all three models, conservative, semi-conservative, and dispersive, half of the DNA is old and half of the DNA is new. But only in semi-conservative is the old version an entire strand, end to end. And the new version is an entire new strand that's complementary to that. That's how this works. I'm not going to get into the historical experiments that led to confirming this, but that's how it works. And as I was talking about last time, the reason that DNA is able to be replicated is because of the strict complementarity with respect to its the hydrogen bonding between nitrogenous bases on at the same position but on opposite strands. So by strict complementarity, I don't just mean purine with pyrimidine. I mean specifically A always with T and C always with G. Because of that, if you were to separate the two strands and hide one of them from me, I could tell you exactly what the sequence is on that hidden strand just by looking at the one that you do show me. And so that's the idea behind semi-conservative replication. The strands separate, and each individual strand serves as a template for how to make a copy of the missing strand. That happens simultaneously, and you end up with two identical copies of the original double-stranded helix. Okay, three. What we're looking at here is DNA replication as it occurs in a prokaryotic cell, which of course has circular DNA. And it's more studied. We know more about the particulars of DNA replication in prokaryotes, specifically E. coli, and that's really what we're going to use as our example as we go through this chapter. But of course, DNA replication occurs in eukaryotic cells as well. The difference is that they have linear chromosomes. But a circular chromosome is still a double helix, so it still has that helical curl to it as it goes around the circle. It's a pretty simple idea here. You have a place on that circle where the replication starts, and that has the pretty descriptive name of origin of replication. And that is where the two strands of the double helix get separated. That's where the separation of the two strands starts. That's where, in other words, the chromosome gets unzipped. And by separating those two strands, you form what is called a replication bubble, kind of a football-shaped opening with two ends called replication forks, where the separation of the two strands has not yet occurred but will continue to occur. So further unzipping makes the replication bubble bigger and bigger. The replication forks move apart from each other. But if you're on a circular chromosome, the unzipping will eventually be such that the two replication forks come back together on the other side, at which case you have two complete chromosomes, assuming that you're not just opening it up, but what happens is that upon opening it up, you use the bare strand, each of them independently, as a template for building a new strand right there on that template. So as that's happening while you're opening up the bubble, by the time you get to the other side of the circular chromosome, you have two identical copies. But notice the coloring here. In each copy, one of the strands is completely old material, one is completely new material. That's the semi-conservative nature. Same is true for the other one. Slide 4 shows you the same thing, just as it happens in a eukaryotic chromosome. Eukaryotic chromosomes are, of course, linear, and so the replication fork would not wrap back on itself ever. Another thing that's true, though, of eukaryotic chromosomes is that they're larger than prokaryotic chromosomes. There's more DNA, nucleotides. And so, whereas there's one origin of replication in a prokaryotic chromosome, there are several different origins of replication along the length of a linear eukaryotic chromosome. They operate the same way, though. Each origin of replication is a place where the two strands get unzipped from each other temporarily. Really, I shouldn't say temporarily. In the case of replication, it's permanent. They never go back together because what's going to take the place of the one that's been separated from it is a brand new strand, just like the one that's been separated from it. But anyway, the point here is that there isn't just one replication bubble that forms in a linear chromosome. There are many along the length. And why would you do this if you were designing things? Why not just have one in the middle and the bubble gets bigger and bigger until it reaches the ends? It takes longer time, right. If you do it simultaneously with many replication bubbles along the length, each bubble only has to get as big as it needs to run into the next bubble. And so you get through the replication process a lot quicker than you would if you just made one bubble that got as big as the entire chromosome. So that's what they mean by the fusion of replicons. Replicons are just basically another name for a replication bubble. Each replication bubble, though, has two replication forks, one on either end. And as you see here in dark and light blue, it's also semi-conservative for eukaryotic cells. Now, I'm not going to read slide 5 to you, but I kept it in here kind of just as a study aid in case you want to look at this. The reason I'm not going to read this to you is because we're going to talk about all these different kinds of proteins along the way anyway, so it's just something for you to use if you want. Slide 6. We see just a little segment of double-stranded DNA here, namely three base pairs worth. The top and the bottom are the same exact piece of DNA, but it's before and after. So this thing is being built. And one thing that's important here is that not just for DNA, in nucleic acids in general, when you polymerize a nucleic acid by adding additional nucleotides to a growing strand, there's only one direction in which that can happen enzymatically. DNA and RNA both have to be built by adding nucleotides to the 3' end. All right, so strands grow in a 5' to 3' direction. But by saying they grow in a 5' to 3' direction, that means you're always adding on to the 3' end. It's the only way it works molecularly and enzymatically in cells. And so you notice that that's what's happening here. The right strand is the template strand. That's the original DNA. That's the dark blue stuff. We're using the nucleotide sequence in that original DNA and complementarity rules as a way of figuring out what particular nucleotides to add one at a time to the new strand that's being built, the light blue strand, in other words, on the left. And a couple have already been put down, right? Thymine was red, that called for adenine. Cytosine was red in the original one, that called for guanine. Now adenine is the one that's being read or being examined enzymatically. And so by strict complementarity rules, that of course calls for thymine. Now, the polynucleotide that we're building, as the name indicates, is a polymer of nucleotides, right? What is a nucleotide? What are the three parts to a nucleotide? Right. A pentose sugar to which two things are connected, right? One of those things on one side of that pentose sugar is a nitrogenous base of some sort. On the other side of that same pentose sugar is a phosphate. If you have all three of those, you have a nucleotide. There are two choices, though, of pentose sugar, right? And so, if you're using ribose, as in ATP, for instance, then we just call those things nucleotides. If we're using deoxyribose, the reason it's called deoxyribose is because it's just like ribose without one of its oxygens. So there's no oxygen in that position, and therefore the nucleotide that deoxyribose is part of is called a deoxynucleotide. And similarly, with nucleosides, right? A nucleoside is a pentose sugar and just a nitrogenous base, no phosphate. So we also use the word deoxynucleoside to specify that the pentose sugar is not ribose, but instead deoxyribose. Right? That's the stuff of DNA. Deoxynucleotides. Those are already in place, right? You have adenine, deoxyribose, and then phosphate on the top there. That's a nucleotide. If it were isolated, it would be a nucleotide. Then you have a nucleotide featuring guanine on the next step down. Now you need one that features thymine. But there, in the nucleotides that DNA is made of, in the final DNA product, those nucleotides have just one phosphate each. That same phosphate that makes a bridge, a covalent bridge with the sugar of the adjacent nucleotide. Well, that qualifies them as nucleotides, right? To be a nucleotide, you need the nitrogenous base, the pentose sugar, and at least one phosphate. So having one phosphate qualifies them as nucleotides. Notice what's coming in, though, as new material. What's coming in as new material is a deoxynucleoside triphosphate, not monophosphate. Now, why do that when you know that what you need to have in the complete product is a nucleoside monophosphate? Why? Exactly. The raw materials for building a DNA polynucleotide are deoxynucleoside triphosphates, not monophosphates, because just like ATP and GTP, which are ribose-based nucleotides, nucleoside triphosphates, they carry energy around with them, right? Energy in the form of those bonds between the phosphates. Well, building a polynucleotide is an expensive process. You should expect it to be an expensive process because it's what metabolic process is that? Well, yes, it's endergonic, but in terms of metabolism, it's anabolic, right? Not catabolic. Anabolic processes are endergonic. It requires energy to build up a big ordered molecule. To make things more orderly requires energy. So that's why you have to bring in these raw materials not as deoxynucleoside monophosphates, which is what they'll be in the final product, but as deoxynucleoside triphosphates, so that splitting off two of the phosphates releases the energy required to drive that endergonic process of forming those phosphodiester bonds that hold the adjacent nucleotides together in the nucleic acid. That's why you have these extra two phosphates. Cleaving those off will leave you in the final product with a deoxynucleoside monophosphate, as it should be. And you see that on the bottom. But those two phosphates that have been cleaved off, symbolized as PP sub I, are what? Well, first of all, what does the I stand for? Inorganic. Why does that make sense? They're no longer attached to anything with carbon in it. They're just phosphate groups on their own. But the two phosphates are still hooked together. And that's why it's PP sub I, not just two P sub I's. What is PP sub I known as in what's its nickname? Not pyruvate. Pyrophosphate. Pyrophosphate. So, you know, in energetic terms, for an ATP molecule, for instance, we're used to thinking that to use that energy, we cleave off one phosphate, which we usually do, right? ATP gets converted into ADP when it's used. Here, we're using the energy by cleaving off two phosphates at once, and that's why you have a pyrophosphate coming off. Now, pyrophosphate doesn't last very long. It's cleaved then into individual inorganic phosphates, and it's part of the phosphate pool that's continuously being reused. So these phosphates might, the next moment, be part of an ATP molecule, for instance. Anyway, that's why you need deoxynucleoside triphosphates, because you need energy to build the nucleic acid. Now let's go to 7. The top part of this, part A, shows you a replication fork, which is just one half of a replication bubble. The same exact thing would be happening on the other side, but diagonally reversed. And you can kind of see that on the bottom. But this is the entire replication bubble. Notice that the same thing is happening in diametric opposition within that bubble. But two different things are happening. There's two different kinds of strands being built here in terms of how we name them. They are called the leading strand and the lagging strand. And the reason that they get these different names is because they are built differently. Because of the fact that I've already told you that the only way you can add nucleotides to a growing strand is to do so at the 3' end, that means one of the strands, one of these types of strands, is going to be built just in one sequence of adding nucleotides. Continuously, in other words. The other strand is going to have to be built piecemeal, a little bit at a time. And the reason for that is that as you open up a replication fork, as you unzip the DNA, one of those strands is going to be opening up in the same direction in which you're going to add nucleotides to. So as you just keep opening it up, you keep adding nucleotides because that's the 3' end. In other words, one of those strands is opening up in the correct direction for building it. The other one, though, because of the anti-parallel nature of DNA, is going to be reversed. And so when you open up the templates, the new strand that's going to be built is going to have its 3' end, the end to which you add new nucleotides, pointed toward the part that has not yet opened up. All right, so, I mean, pointed away from that. Pointed in the opposite direction compared to the leading strand. So that means you can't just open it up and keep adding ones to that 3' end because the 3' end is pointed in the other direction. Therefore, you have to open it up enough so that you can make a little fragment called an Okazaki fragment. And then open it up some more until you can build a new Okazaki fragment to approach the previous Okazaki fragment, and so on. So the lagging strand, and there are two lagging strands, like I said, one for each of the two replication forks. The lagging strand is built by producing a bunch of little Okazaki fragments that then get sewn together. Now, no strand, whether it's leading or lagging, can be built unless you first lay down a little bit of nucleic acid in the form of an RNA primer. And notice I said RNA primer. Now the intent, of course, is to build a DNA molecule, and the final product needs to better be pure DNA, only with deoxyribose as the sugars for each nucleotide. The problem is, when you build a nucleic acid, if it's DNA that you're building, you can't have DNA nucleotide as your first nucleotide. You can't lay it down onto nothing, in other words. You can only add DNA nucleotides or deoxynucleotides to an existing strand. RNA nucleotides, on the other hand, can be put down onto nothing. They can be the first nucleotide laid down. And therefore, they have to be in DNA replication, even though the intent is to build a DNA nucleotide. So the little red sections are RNA primers. It's just a short sequence of RNA nucleotides. And those get put down so that there is something to build on. And then, according to the complementarity of the template strand that's being read, DNA nucleotides get added one by one to the 3' end of the RNA primer originally, and then to the DNA strand that's being built. What this means in terms of lagging versus leading strands is that the leading strand requires just one RNA primer to get it going. And since the replication fork is opening up in the direction that's correct for adding new nucleotides to that strand, DNA nucleotides just keep getting added to that ever-growing strand. till that replication bubble hits another replication bubble. But on the lagging strand, you're going to need a different primer, a different RNA primer for each Okazaki fragment. All right, so you open this up enough so that you can put down a primer and then just fill in the gap between that Okazaki fragment's primer and the next Okazaki fragment's primer. Now, the lagging strand is going to end up being the same length as the leading strand. It's just going to be full of a lot more RNA primers than the leading strand. Either way, whether it's just one leading strand's primer or many lagging strand's primers, those primers need to be gotten rid of eventually, right? They can't be in the final product. So different enzymes do different jobs in this process, including getting rid of these RNA primers and replacing them with DNA. Talk about that in a minute. Slide 8. There are different versions of polymerase molecules, but polymerase obviously is an enzyme, right? And therefore a protein. Polymerases get their name because they polymerize nucleic acid. So there are RNA polymerases, there are DNA polymerases. Here we care about DNA polymerases because that's what we're trying to build, a DNA molecule. And like I said, we're mostly focusing on what happens in an E. coli. There are different groups of organisms use different versions of polymerases. But DNA polymerase 3 is the main enzyme used by prokaryotic cells to add DNA nucleotides one by one to the growing strand that's being built according to the complementarity rules and using the original DNA strand as the template for determining that complementarity. All right, so we've already assumed here that the strands have been separated from each other. We're reading the original strand, which is the darker blue, and we're trying to add new strand in light blue according to the complementarity rules by reading that. Well, it's DNA polymerase 3 that does that reading, in a sense, based on whatever that original DNA nucleotide is in the template strand. The complementary deoxynucleoside triphosphate will come in and be added, cleaving off the pyrophosphate. Now that happens remarkably well, meaning not all that many mistakes happen, but a fair amount of mistakes do happen. And if you're talking about mistakes in DNA, that can have a drastic effect on things. So DNA polymerase also has its own error checking mechanism. So that when it does occasionally add the wrong nucleotide, like what is happening right here where it's indicated as incorrect base, the DNA polymerase will notice that, and as soon as it makes that mistake, it will correct it. It will cleave off that wrong nucleotide. Notice that it's called exonuclease cleavage. Why exonuclease? Because you're cutting that nucleic acid at the end. Remember I was talking about restriction enzymes being endonucleases, cutting it somewhere in the middle of the strand. Here you're taking one off of the extreme end. That's why it's an exonuclease activity. So it added one, it notices it's wrong, it cleaves it right off, and then replaces it with the one that should be there. And so because of this built-in error checking mechanism, even though a lot of mistakes are made when you're talking about the billions of times this has to happen, just for one cell reproducing, a huge number of those mistakes get corrected right away. Therefore, even though some mistakes slip by, those mistakes are pretty rare. And what do we call those mistakes, by the way? Mutations, right. Well, that's one way for a mutation to occur. There's different ways for mutation to occur, but mutation can occur just because of a mistake in DNA replication. Anyway, let's go to 9 and talk about some more of the proteins involved. Now, primase, the one in orange, is well-named enzyme. It's called that because it's the enzyme responsible for laying down the RNA primer that you have to have because you can't just start with DNA. So the red section here, notice any sequence, actually even a single nucleotide, but even a very short sequence of nucleotides has a 5' and a 3' end to it. So there's always directionality to a strand, no matter how many nucleotides or how few are involved. Even this short RNA primer has a 3' end, and therefore that's the end that DNA has to be added to. You can't add DNA simultaneously to both ends of the primer, in other words. The primer has directionality to it. DNA grows from just that 3' end. But first you have to have that primer laid down to begin with, and that's primase's job. It's only just a small number of nucleotides long. Then you have DNA polymerase 3, like I said. We're assuming this is a prokaryote. Add one by one DNA nucleotides to this growing strand using the template as a guide. It'll do that until it either reaches the end, until there are no more nucleotides to be read, or until it runs into another primer. All right? In the case of Okazaki fragments. Well, when that happens, there are the correct number of nucleotides already. But it's not the finished product yet for a couple reasons. One is that you have to get rid of that RNA, of course, replace it with the appropriate DNA nucleotides that are just like the RNA primer, only with deoxyribose as the sugar. The other thing is when you're talking about our DNA polymerase adding DNA nucleotides all the way until it fills all the space to the next RNA primer that it meets. DNA polymerase 3 is not able to make a phosphodiester bond with that primer. Now, first of all, it wouldn't want to because the primer needs to be removed. But even if it were DNA that we're running into, all that DNA polymerase 3 can do is fill in the gaps, fill in the missing nucleotides. It can't sew the 3' end of that strand to the 5' end of the strand it runs into. It can't make that final phosphodiester bond, in other words. So that's why you need a different kind of enzyme. Well, two enzymes come into play here. One is an enzyme necessary for removing the RNA primer. Once you have all the space filled, so you have the proper number of nucleotides, no more nucleotides to be added, the next problem is you need to get rid of the RNA. And so that's a different kind of polymerase that does that job. It's DNA polymerase 1 that will go get those RNA primers out of there and then replace them with the correct version, the DNA version, correct DNA version of those nucleotides. That will, once again, leave you with the situation in which all the nucleotides are in place. There's no gaps, in other words. But even DNA polymerase 1 is not able to make that final phosphodiester bond. So even when you have pure DNA and as many DNA nucleotides as you need, you still have nicks. You have a nick for every RNA primer that you had there originally. So if it weren't for the fact that this thing is hydrogen bonded to the template strand, you wouldn't have one strand of new DNA. You'd have several strands that need to be sewn together. While they're still hydrogen bonded to the original template strand, these individual snippets are polymerized. They are sewn together by forming the final phosphodiester bonds, and that's the job of still another enzyme, which we call ligase. DNA ligase is so called why? Well, ligand is something that is ligated. To ligate means to tie or bind. So DNA ligase gets its name because it makes that final tying up or sewing together of the individual DNA snippets. And when that happens, then you have one continuous DNA strand that's just as long as, just as many nucleotides long as the template strand was. Meanwhile, the same exact thing is happening for the other original template strand, except the two new strands are going to be complementary to each other, right? Just because of complementarity rules. But when that happens simultaneously, now you have two complete chromosomes that are copied. I shouldn't say chromosomes. You have two complete double-stranded DNA molecules, which are just part of chromosomes. Okay, 10. We have already been assuming that the unzipping has occurred, but there is a protein acting as an enzyme that does this unzipping, and that's called helicase. Helicase furthers the unzipping at each replication fork. Helicase is the yellowish one you see labeled. At each replication fork, helicase breaks those hydrogen bonds between complementary nucleotides at the same position but in opposite strands. And this is where it comes into play that you want those things to be hydrogen bonds so that they are easy to break, right? Whereas you want the strand to be held together by covalent bonds, phosphodiester bonds, so that the code is intact. Imagine doing this with a rope. If you had just a two-stranded rope and attached it to a wall at one end and you separated the two strands from each other at the other end, the more you did that, the more it would supercoil the rope, right, where in the direction toward the wall. And that's exactly what happens with helicase. As helicase unzips the DNA, it causes supercoiling ahead of it in the direction where it hasn't yet been opened up. And so that supercoiling tension needs to be relieved now and again. So that's the job of still another protein acting as an enzyme. And there's different versions of them for different types of organisms, but they belong to something I've already told you, the class of proteins called topoisomerases. So specifically for E. coli, that would be gyrase. Gyrase is just an example of a topoisomerase. But these type 2 topoisomerases make cuts in the DNA where it's being supercoiled and let them flop around, basically, relieve the tension, and then bind them back together. This is a little bit like, well, this analogy is kind of dying out because there aren't also that many corded telephones anymore. But on a corded desk telephone with a handset and the actual phone on the desk, you know, you use that long enough that the cord between the handset and the phone gets very tangled. And so what you have to do for that, if you want to quickly get rid of that, is to just take the modular plug out, let the tension flop it back around, and then plug it back in. That's kind of what topoisomerase does to relieve that tension as it's being built by helicase unzipping the two strands. So anyway, that's the point of 10. Two more players in the game. There's all kinds of proteins involved in this. Most of them are acting as enzymes. There's an exception to that, though, too, and we'll see that in slide 11. Now, even helicase, even the operation of helicase, doesn't make sense unless we assume that the two strands have been separated from each other at the origin of replication to begin with. We've just been assuming that all along as well. Well, there's a separate protein responsible for that first separation of the two strands from each other at an origin of replication. And you can see that that is called an initiator protein, the orangish one at the top. So there are different versions of this as well in different organisms. Yeah. You're talking about transcription, not replication. No, you're talking about what's happening in transcription, not replication. So we'll talk about that's another function of DNA, right? Building a different kind of nucleic acid in that case. But anyway, the initiator protein is the protein that recognizes the origin of replication based on its short sequence of DNA nucleotides and makes that first severance or cutting of the hydrogen bonding between the complementary bases. It forms this very small replication bubble, in other words, so that then helicase can get in there and do its job of continuing the unzipping. All right, that's the initiator protein. Now, if you imagine separating, you know, forming a replication bubble by separating the two complementary strands, the two strands that have been separated from each other were held together for good reason. They are perfectly complementary, right? Therefore, if you just unzip them and then let go, what's going to happen? They're going to go right back together. And that would undo what you're trying to do. So you need another protein, and this is the one that's not actually acting as an enzyme, but it is a protein player in the game, that can temporarily clamp the two strands apart from each other so that the other enzymes that we've been talking about can do their jobs. And that protein is called single-strand binding protein. As the name implies, it binds to one of the two strands, but it basically just stays in the way, disallowing the two strands from reannealing or coming back together. And it does that long enough so that helicase can get in there and do the unzipping job, and then also DNA polymerase 3 can get in there after helicase unzips. Well, primase gets in there first, sorry. Put the primer down, then DNA polymerase 3 gets in there and lays down the nucleotides. Once you have that, it doesn't matter whether you let go because the new strand is already in that position. So the original strands are going to ignore each other at that point. So single-strand binding protein, and actually all of these proteins as a complex, move along with the replication fork as it gets unzipped. All right. The bottom shows you that on the leading strand you just have DNA polymerase 3 adding continuously. For the lagging strand you need primase in there for each of the individual primers and then DNA polymerase 3 to move it or to add new ones to fill those gaps, making several different Okazaki fragments. Okay, slide 12. Here we're looking at what happens in a eukaryotic cell. And the big difference, of course, is the shape of the chromosome. If you have a circular chromosome, even though there is a starting place, the origin of replication, there aren't any ends to the strands, right? You can think of it as a start-finish line, but it's not a true actual end of the strand. Whereas in a linear chromosome, as you have in eukaryotic chromosome or organisms, there are actual ends, two ends to each DNA, each double strand of DNA. And that poses a problem because of what I was saying about not being able to lay down DNA onto nothing. All right. Well, you have a bunch of replication bubbles. Everything goes fine until you reach these ends. Now, at each end, only one of the two strands is going to be problematic. When you get to the very end and you put down that RNA primer, That will allow you to build the DNA from that primer, no problem. But when it comes time to replacing that primer with DNA, the cell is unable to because it's at the very end of the strand. So you can get rid of the RNA, you just can't replace it with DNA. And that's why you leave a little gap. What that means is that every cell generation, a eukaryotic chromosome's DNA is a little bit shorter. Okay, you have the same exact thing happening at the other end, but it will be on the other strand. So each strand gets a little bit shorter, some number of nucleotides shorter, because of the inability to put DNA on the very end of the strand. Well, this could be a huge problem, right? Now, getting rid of DNA isn't necessarily a problem because of what I've told you already, namely that the vast majority of your DNA is not gene DNA, right? It's non-coding regions. And so you can actually afford to just eliminate some DNA nucleotides. They're not only genes, but they might be doing nothing. So you might be able to get away with that for one generation or some number of generations. It doesn't matter how many generations, though, you can get away with it. Eventually, you're going to run into the problem that the shortening will actually start eliminating gene nucleotides, nucleotides that are actually parts of genes. And when you do that, you're destroying genes. Eventually, in enough generations, the cell would no longer be viable. It wouldn't have enough genes to live, right? So there needs to be a way around this problem. The ends of eukaryotic chromosomes are called telomeres. And telomeres are sequences of non-coding DNA. They're not only non-coding, they really don't do anything else as well. They're just there as leader sequences. Now, does anyone remember film? It's all digital nowadays, but I'm talking about cinematic film that you have to actually string through a projector. Right? You have a leader on that. The very first piece of film is not the first frame of the movie. You have a leader because you have to string it through the machine, and there has to be enough distance to get it on the reel before you actually display that first frame of the movie. Well, doing that over and over on an old film, it wrecks the leader. It gets into bad shape. So what's the solution is you cut it off a little bit at a time, just like DNA gets shortened a little bit each generation. And that's no problem because there's a long leader sequence. But if you kept doing that, eventually you'd be cutting into the movie itself, and the very first thing projected would be some number of frames beyond the beginning of the movie. You'd lose information, right? That's what would happen in a cell. So the solution is to just every now and then add new leader so that it can then be eroded away, and then you add more later, and then therefore you're never getting into the important DNA. That's what's shown on slide 13. Telomeres are the very tips of these eukaryotic DNA molecules, and a special enzyme called telomerase is named for the fact that new leaders are added to the telomeres by this telomerase enzyme. So the sequence is just a repeating sequence that this enzyme is responsible for adding to the ends. So it's not reading any code from a template. It's just putting down its own sequence, which is why it's able to do it. And this allows then for that problem of the gaps not mattering. It just doesn't matter in that case. By the way, the number of times that a cell can replicate is kind of defined by whether telomerase is used to add leaders or not. And so there's all kinds of hypotheses about why have this problem to begin with, why not just have circular DNA. Well, for one thing, one reason is that it might give us resistance to cancer, because the only cells in our body that we need to never be eroded are our germline cells. Those are the ones that we pass on to the next generation. The cells of our own body only need to last a certain number of generations for our lifetime. A cancer cell is out of control dividing, so it's going through cell generations much more often than a normal cell. Well, if the cancer cell doesn't have telomerase activity, it will eventually kill itself because its DNA gets too short. That's one hypothesis, at least. Anyway, I'm out of time.